Looks like participants are coming in. Welcome to everyone.
Yeah, I see James Constantian's back with us.
Oh, Jim, it's good to see you too.
Yeah. All right. Church historian.
Well, as people are coming in, I welcome everyone to Hugh Ross's Paradoxes class. Remind everyone that if you have a question, please post it in the Q&A, and then it'll be orally communicated to Hugh by me. And then if you have questions that you want to ask other people in the group, use the chat. Or if you just want to talk, use the chat. So the Q&A is only for questions, and we take one question at a time per person. You can post as many questions as you want, but we'll only ask one of them and give other people a chance to get in as well. So we hope everybody has a great chance of asking the questions. We're going to do it a little differently this time. Hugh will talk about it a little bit more later on, but for those of you who don't get your Q&A done in this pre-webinar session, you will have a little bit of time afterwards to, we'll go through the Q&A after the webinar in the webinar session, and we'll do some Q&A there before we go to the web meeting. So that'll get announced more in more detail later on. So we have no questions right now, but we looks like the chat's opening up. Have you seen any kind of new apologetic questions arising in the past week?
Well, I've been really engaged in looking at all the different theologians, and I mean, what's interesting is that you're seeing an uptick in dual revelation practices in the cults and a drop within Christianity. So I find that quite interesting. But in terms of new discoveries, Fuzz has got a great discovery. By the way, this week we're going to begin recording a new podcast, a video podcast, where we're going to be bringing in people from our scholar community, as well as our staff scholars, to talk about the past week's scientific discoveries that give us more evidence for the Christian faith. It'll be like the creation update we used to do many years ago, only we've significantly upgraded the video quality of it. So, and you know, I'm going to be out of town at the end of February, but they're going to bring me in via video. We have the capability of doing that. So we're going to be able to do that with a number of our scholars. And so on a weekly basis, you're going to be hearing about three to as many as five scientific discoveries that are giving us more evidence for the Christian faith. So we're going to the studio Wednesday to record some. We'll be doing that every week.
Wow. Chris Thompson from Anchorage asks, a cross-reference is needed for your many books and versions. Any progress being made? What new material changes are in each edition?
Yeah, what we try to do when we bring out a new edition is tell you what's new in the edition. And some editions are, we call it a reprinting of all we're doing is, relatively minor adjustments. But we call it a new edition if we're actually adding content. So some significant content. But there's some editions of my books where we've added as much as 100 pages of new content. A good example of that is The Creator and the Cosmos, the fourth edition. It's got 100 pages of new content. The book isn't 100 pages longer because we took out about 15 pages of content. And we said, hey, this is very well covered in new books we've brought out. So we basically deleted several pages down to a single paragraph and told people, hey, this is where you can go to get more. But we literally added 100 pages of new content. So often when authors do that, they change the title, but we said, no, we're going to keep the title. So.
Yeah, that's pretty tricky. Some places they change the title of the book and make people buy it, even though it's the same book that's already been published.
Well, we don't make money on our books. So that's not an issue for us. So you know, our goal is to basically price the books so we break even.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, when you earlier mentioned something about the occult and the dual revelation, what were you talking about there? I didn't quite understand that.
Well, what I've noticed, for example, with the Jehovah's Witnesses, in the old days, they were kind of promoting a young earth perspective. They've now stopped that cold. In fact, they've made it very explicit that they're old earth. They've adopted a day age interpretation of Genesis 1. So let's say the days are consecutive, long periods of time. And as I read their material, people have been telling me this for a couple of decades now, Hugh, they must be reading your books because they basically adopt the same interpretation that we do here at the Reasons to Believe. And they put it in print. And I've noticed in the old days, they're really promoting fulfilled prophecy and how Armageddon is just around the corner. What I see, they backed off quite a bit from that, mainly because they've been wrong so often. So they pulled back from that, and they're no longer claiming, hey, next year, Jesus is coming back. Get ready, join us. They've backed away from that, although quite a few of their people are still pushing 2034 as the beginning of Armageddon. But if you go on their website, you really don't see that anymore. But you do see a lot of their science apologetics and their scientific concordism. I've also noticed the Christadelphians have gone down the same path. It used to be a lot like the Jehovah's Witnesses, where they're very heavy on Bible prophecy and how we're coming in to the end times. I see them pulling back from that and promoting much more of a scientific concordism. And unlike Mormonism, they're really trying to come up with a credible scientific concordism. But yeah, it's interesting to see how much apparently they have borrowed from us. Of course, we're not claiming to be unique providers of this. They could be getting it from other sources.
Yes, I've noticed that too. I've had several encounters with Jehovah's Witnesses since I moved to where I'm living now. Some of them drop things off at the door. Some of them were walking around the neighborhood, and you know, if you walk up the sidewalk, they'll just stop you and hand you something. The documentation on creation was, I thought the same thing you did. I said, they've got to be reading Reasons to Believe stuff because this is really clear and it really is consistent. And I thought, this they're doing something right. I mean, there's a lot they're doing wrong. Obviously, their theology is off. But they're definitely well,
some theologians have told me that the timing doesn't look coincidental. They changed their whole perspective on the Bible and science after we came up with our books laying out the material. So they're saying, I think they're reading your material. However, they're definitely not reading our stuff on the Trinity. Or if they are, they're ignoring what we're writing.
Yeah, that part they can't dispense that, or so they end up becoming a different religion.
Yeah, they do.
Keith Wilson asked whether the Jehovah's Witnesses still hold to an eternal earth.
They are claiming that Jesus is going to come back here and rule here on planet Earth. And that's one reason why they have a very small number of people that actually get saved. Because after all, the living space of the Earth isn't that great. So, yeah. In fact, there's only 144,000 that actually are in the top tier. So that's one problem, is that you got first-class Christians and their theology, and second-class. And again, the Christadelphians are very similar. Much smaller organization, but virtually the same beliefs.
Hmm. So they're not Trinitarians or Christadelphians?
No, they're not.
Okay.
Yeah. Similar to Jehovah's Witness, they believe that Jesus is subordinate, which they mean inferior, and that he didn't really exist until God had created him. So yeah, they don't see him as fully God.
Got it. We have a question from Esther McCorkle. Oh, yes. Recent studies about the humoral innate immunity response to the SARS-2 COVID-19 infections in our bodies seem to add another layer to the wonders of the human body. And as a layperson, I've tried to understand the recent articles on this ongoing study. Can you add any information on this? I hope to share this as the fearfully and wonderfully made statement in the Bible.
Yeah, I can recommend to Esther that she look at the articles that Faisal Rana is posting on her website. And he's got several more that are coming. And basically his point is that when you look at the human genome, you see these endogenous retroviruses. In other words, pieces of the genome that look a lot like the DNA of viruses. And evolutionists have said, hey, this is just, common descent where you got creatures incorporating the DNA when they get invaded by viruses. But the fuzzest point is this is built into the DNA on purpose in order to defend against viral attacks. And especially, and people are saying, why does the human genome have so many of them? Well, we live 80, 90 years. And so we're going to be subject to a lot more viral exposure than a creature that lives only for 1 or 2 years. And so we shouldn't be surprised that we have all these endogenous retroviruses. But Fuzz's whole point is these are segments of our genome that are not there through evolutionary incursion. They're there on purpose to provide us with the defenses we need against viral attacks.
Good, thank you. Doug McComb from Monrovia says, what's the difference between the perfect will of God and the permissive will of God? And can believers ever be in the perfect will of God, or are we not perfect yet, and that would include our actions? He has a follow-up question, but let's work on that one first.
Well, it's probably something that's more in your territory than my territory, Mark. This whole idea of, what part is debatable and what part is not debatable? And, Christian theologians have been debating Doug's question for 2,000 years. I think the most significant part of the debate, how do we distinguish between the clear will, moral of God, and what's permissible? And so, obviously, we're all called to obey that which God has laid out in the Ten Commandments and the Great Commandment, for example. But things like, what is the permissible will of God? That's going to differ for each individual. So, how much alcohol would be appropriate to drink for one person may be different for another person. So, I can tell you this, a new study came out basically saying any amount of alcohol is not good for your heart. So, I think I posted an article several months ago, maybe a year and a half ago now, where the U.S. medical industry was saying, 1 or 2 drinks a day is not going to affect your health. And now they're saying, hey, we need to lower that to 3 drinks a week. So, that would be okay, anything above that. That's just an example how we're talking about the permissible will of God. Jesus drank wine. How much is okay and how much is not okay? And it depends what you're drinking, and it depends on your body type, what's going to work. So again, I think Christians are going to be debating this for a long time. The real important part is, where's the boundary between what is permissible and what needs to be obeyed by all?
Wonderful, thank you. David Siri asks, I was reviewing the recordings of your teaching on Revelation and noticed you mentioned that 120 of the 300 prophecies concerning the modern state of Israel had been fulfilled as of 1988. I was wondering if you have this list and maybe give an update on where these prophecies are now.
Well, I taught that class 30, 40 years ago. And at that time, you didn't have the internet. And so all the notes were basically in written form. In fact, a lot of them were just simply mimeographed. I do have the mimeographs. They are archived at the Reasons to Believe head office. So if I mention something that's written, as you take that 7.5-year course, you can get it. But what we have to do is photocopy it and mail it to you. A few of the items are now in digital form, but only a few. But we're looking for volunteers to be prepared to take all that material and to put it in digital form. But so far, no one has stepped up to do all that. What was remarkable is we had this lady in our class, Susan, who took all the recordings that we did over 7 years and 9 months and put it into MP3s. And those are posted at the paradoxes.org website. But people often ask me, are there any more prophecies that have been fulfilled by the modern nation of Israel since we made that list in the early 1980s? And the answer is yes, there are some additional ones. Back in the early 1980s, we were looking at a population of Jews in Israel that was roughly equivalent to the population of Jews in greater New York City. Now the population of Jews living in Israel has more than double the population of Jews living in New York City. And the context there is a prophecy in Ezekiel, a day will come when all the Jews will be living in the land of Israel. And so now more than half the Jews in the world are living in the land of Israel, but only slightly more than half. So we got a ways to go before that one is fulfilled. Another one would be the prophecy that a time will come when Israel will be the richest nation. And I think the way I interpret that is the richest per capita nation on the world. And what's happened since the early 1980s is that figure has certainly gone way up. And today, Israel ranks second in all the nations of the world in terms of companies that are on the NASDAQ stock exchange. And given their small population, that's a remarkable achievement.
Indeed. Thank you. We're about ready to start the webinar. I want to remind people that after we're done with the webinar, we will still continue working from this list in the Q&A before we go to the meeting. Also, next week, Hugh Ross will be gone, but Ross Hoagland will be here, and he's going to be doing a session on prayer and evangelism and apologetics, how those three merge and how they're effective in doing what we're supposed to be doing with apologetics, which is bringing people to Christ and discipling those who are already with Christ. So with that, we will start next week at 10:30 Pacific time instead of 10:45. So we'll get Ross Hoagland in earlier. I think his will be a little bit longer than normal, but he will also have Q&A next week. So next week we start at 10:30 for everybody, and it will be recorded. And with that, Hugh, it's your webinar now. If you could open us in prayer, then it's all yours. Thank you.
Yes, and I really appreciate that. What we're going to be hearing from Ross Hoagland is how important it is when you're sharing your faith to pray. You want to be a better evangelist? Prayer is definitely a crucial point. So with that, let me pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we can gather together here in the Paradoxes virtual world. We look forward to a time we can be meeting both virtually and in person. So Father, we've asked that your hand would be upon this virus. Lord, that it would come under control. Give us the wisdom and the capability to bring it under control so that we can begin to socially engage like we did before. And Father, I pray that this day you would open up our hearts to receive your light, your life, love, and truth. Lord, that we would allow your Holy Spirit to transform us through that light that you send to us. And help us, Father, too, to encourage one another as we engage one another in the webinar, but especially in the web meeting. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, welcome to all of you. And I'm going to share screen now. And people, yeah, by the way, I will be in Austin, Texas next Sunday. So I'll be speaking there for 3 days to high schools, colleges, and churches, as well as our chapter there in Austin, Texas. Really appreciate Ross Hoagland stepping in while I am there. So let me share screen. Okay, you should all be seeing my first slide now. And let me get my second computer set up the way it's supposed to be. Here we go. All right. Okay, this is the alternate Sunday where I also begin the class with some new scientific discoveries that make a stronger case for the Christian faith and the inspiration and inerrancy of the Bible. And so I've come this Sunday. These are two very recently published papers, and they're related to one another. Slightly different topics, but they make the same point. So I'm going to try to quickly get through these two here. And this first slide is just a reminder. I do take questions on Facebook and Twitter, as do all the Reasons to Believe scholars. I don't have Instagram, but the Reasons to Believe website does have Instagram. And yeah, if you're not already a subscriber to the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel, you can subscribe to free. And there's now thousands of video clips there that you can watch. And this is the first book I've written on the topic of dual revelation that we're studying in the class right now. Actually, there's just a couple of chapters on it and more than a theory. The book is more focused on the falsifiable, testable, predictive creation model we've developed at Reasons to Believe. But anyone can get a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross, or if you choose, you can get a free chapter of one of my other books. The one item we do have in the Reasons to Believe store that's specifically on dual revelation is this docudrama titled Dual Revelation. And this is the address that you're going to need, the URL you're going to need to get into the web meeting when we're finished with the webinar this morning. I'll put this slide up again just before we transition from the webinar to the web meeting. But as we announced, we're going to split the second Q&A session. Part one will be in the webinar. Part two will be in the web meeting. I'll say more about that a little bit later. And this is in the chat as well as at paradoxes.org. It's the same URL we've been using for the past many months. And before I jump into these new scientific discoveries, let me give you the biblical context. And this is out of Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. And now I would commend to you verses 28, 29, and 30. Those three verses is where God is basically saying to Adam and Eve, and through them to all human beings, I'm making you in charge, you're magistrates. I've put the planet Earth under your control. And he's basically saying, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. So God's goal is that humanity would occupy the entire landmass surface of the earth. Be fruitful, increase in number, and subdue it. For what reason? We need a lot of people over all the landmasses of the earth in order to be able to manage all the resources of planet Earth and what it says here for your benefit and the benefit of all of their life. Rule over the fish of the sea, govern them, and over every living creature that moves on the ground. So God is making us responsible to manage the resources of planet Earth for our specific benefit, but also for the benefit of all of their life on planet Earth. And if you read on into verses 29 and 30, it's extending this from the animal life on planet Earth to all life on planet Earth, the microbes, the plants, the vegetation, everything, and basically says in verse 30, pay particular care to wisely manage the photosynthetic life, because that's the base of the food chain. All life on planet Earth fundamentally depends on a photosynthetic life. And, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, I'm old enough to remember all the Apollo launches. But I can recall very vividly Apollo 8. That was the first time the Saturn V rocket was launched, where they had three astronauts in the capsule, and they had them orbit the moon. So Apollo 8 was the first time that human beings had actually orbited around the moon. But the three astronauts that were on board the spacecraft, Frank Borman, Bill Anders, and James Lovell, were all believers. And And also, this is the first time they actually had this recorded live on television. Over a billion human beings at that time watched Apollo 8 orbiting the moon live on television. And so it was Frank Borman and Bill Anders, under the encouragement of James Lovell, that picked up a Bible and read through Genesis chapter 1. So I thought that was wonderful. You know, a billion human beings, over a billion, heard these two astronauts reading, going back and forth, one verse at a time, going through a good chunk of a Genesis chapter 1. And I'm going to pop up here a YouTube URL. I'll leave this up for a little bit. I think this is quite encouraging because what it is the actual recording of Frank Borman and Bill Anders reading from the book of Genesis to all the peoples of the world as they're orbiting the moon. So yes, Genesis 1 is the text, and it's not the only text. You can also go to Job 37 through to 42, makes the same point. God has put us in charge of planet Earth or to manage its resources for our benefit and the benefit of all life. And if you haven't had time to write down the URL that I put up here, if you simply go into Apollo 8 and Genesis, I think it'll bring to you this YouTube URL, and you can watch and listen to the video recording of the two of them commenting or reading exactly out of the Bible. Okay. The first discovery I want to mention here is the one about forests and grass fires and the role that certain animals on the face of the earth play in ensuring we get just the right number and intensity of forests and grass fires. And, you know, we're living in a time when these forests and grass fires are really way beyond the norm. So this is a forest fire that was burning in Yosemite a number of years ago. This next slide here shows you grass fires. And the article I'm going to be referring to is predominantly about grass fires and how we need these grass fires. We also need forest fires. They're the ones that put charcoal into the soil, and that charcoal plays a crucial role in the preserving the nutrients in the soil and in getting the right soil conditioning so you get the water, right amount of water transport to the roots. And so we need regular forest and grass fires in order to keep the plant ecosystem as healthy and as abundant as possible. But obviously too many forest and grass fires have the opposite effect. They wind up wiping out way more vegetation than would otherwise take the place. And this article is based on the fact that in the last few decades, we've seen a really sharp increase in the number of forests and grass fires around the world. And this graph basically shows you the wildfire extent in the United States, basically demonstrating that in terms of numbers of acres burnt, and this means, you know, where they're completely burnt to the ground, where over 80% of the vegetation is wiped out. Those kinds of grass and forest fires have tripled in just 30 years. So we're seeing this increase, and it's a, you know, and the whole point of this paper is, what's the cause of this increase? And we're actually seeing an increase over the past 130,000 years, but the most dramatic increase we're seeing in the last three decades. And on a worldwide basis, this paper is making the point that if you look at the satellites' data and what they're seeing from ground-based observations, in terms of grass and forest fires, it's wiping out an area of the world on a per-year basis. This is not a cumulative. This is per year. Wildfire extent worldwide over this three-year period, 2006, 2007, 2008, consume 13% more land area than all of India. That would include what it claims in Kashmir, as well as East India and West India. You can throw in all of Nepal. All of that gets wiped out every single year. So this is a significant fraction of the landmass of planet Earth, and this is way beyond the historical norm. Now, what the authors did, it's a large team of international and multidisciplinary team published in the December issue of Science. And what they did is they used charcoal proxies all over the world to determine the extent of wildfires over the past 130,000 years. Charcoal contains carbon, so they can get carbon-14 dating. There's other dating tools that they can use. They can tell by looking at the isotope ratios in the charcoal, what the extent of the wildfire that was taking place and the date from when the wildfires occurred. And so through those charcoal proxy studies, they were able to demonstrate that North and South America by far had the greatest increase in grassland fires since 130,000 years ago. And say, why did they go back 130,000 years? Well, you know, what you see in the fossil record is 130,000 years ago, we had all over the world a much larger and diverse population of what are called mega herbivores. And today it's much less. So this paper is basically investigating, is there a correlation between the decrease in mega herbivores and the fact that we're seeing a big increase in the grassland fires. And they noted North America and South America is where we see this huge increase in grassland fires. And we already know that North America and South America suffered severe extinctions of these mega herbivores. So here's North and South America. They had much higher rates of mega herbivore extinctions compared to Europe and Africa and Asia. And they define mega herbivores as creatures that weigh more than 1,000 kilograms. So that's 2,200 pounds. Anything that's more than a long ton, a metric ton, would be in this category. Elephants clearly are in this category. They come in at 6 to 7 metric tons. So they're big creatures. And here you can see how they're able to get vegetation that other animals are not able to get. You know, here's this elephant actually pulling down branches from trees that are 18 feet above the ground. And then you got the rhinoceros. Again, a very big, heavy creature. And a point is a mega herbivore has to consume a lot of food in order to keep going. And so they strip the land of vegetation that otherwise would be burnt in a wildfire. And so this is what they were testing is, here we got giraffes. And Africa had only a 4% extinction rate of mega herbivores. North and South America, much higher rates of extinction. But, you know, we still have mega herbivores in North America. This is a young bull moose. So it's the largest mega herbivore in North America today. One of the few mega herbivores is left. But if you go back into the last ice age, we had really big mega herbivores. Here's the woolly mammoth, which actually had a larger body mass than we see in the largest elephants on the planet Earth today, and these enormous tusks. And they were quite abundant on North America. In fact, so abundant that a lot of my friends in Canada have got fossils of these creatures. My dad had fossils of one of these, actually had most of the leg bone of one of these woolly mammoths, and he had a good chunk of one of the tusks as well. And in fact, they were so abundant in Canada that even today, the Canadian government will serve mammoth meat at state dinners. Yes, it's thousands of years old, But because parts of Canada are frozen almost all the time, there's actually frozen mammoth meat. That's just like the meat in your freezer. You can pull it and thaw it, and then you can actually serve it up. So one mammoth feeds, what, 5,000 people? So, and to give an idea how big these creatures were, here's the bones of a woolly mammoth, and you can see the human beings off to the right end of this museum. So yeah, really large creature here. And this actually shows you the extent of these woolly mammoths that existed during the last ice age. Notice that almost the entirety of North America was inhabited by these woolly mammoths. You know, all of Canada, except for the Northern Islands, all of the United States, all of Mexico, only Panama and Costa Rica, Nicaragua didn't have the woolly mammoth. And again, if you go over to Europe and Asia, again, more than half of Europe and Asia was occupied by these woolly mammoths, even on the island of Borneo. They did not exist in South America, Africa, or Australia. But yeah, they went extinct during the last ice age. And not only were there these large elephant-sized creatures roaming all over North America, there was also an abundance of camels, creatures like this, and they qualify as mega herbivores. They come in at more than 2,200 pounds. But what Karp et al. Had documented in their paper published in Science is that the adult body size in North America shrank from 1,060 kilograms down to just 140 kilograms. And the extinction rate was 68%. 68% of these species of life that came in with adult body sizes greater than 1,000 kilograms are now completely gone from North America. And the average body size literally shrank by a factor of about 8 times, and was much more devastating in South America than North America. In South America, the extinction rate was 83%, and the adult body size shrank from 950 kilograms down to just 60 kilograms. Now, this is focusing on the grazing mammals. This study did not look at the carnivores, but obviously if you're wiping out the mega herbivores, that's also going to impact the carnivores that depend on those creatures for food. They're no longer going to have that as a food source. So yes, the carnivores were also largely impacted, and both North America and South America likewise suffered a high extinction rate of the mega carnivores. But the paper really didn't address that. It focused on the grazing mammals because their interest was how this affects forest and grass fires. Now, let me talk about the fact that there's actually extinction going on in real time with these creatures. One example would be the caribou. This is a photograph of a caribou in British Columbia, also known as a reindeer. In Canada, they call them caribou, but everywhere else they call them a reindeer. And when I was a child growing up in British Columbia, caribou were so incredibly plentiful that there was an open hunting season that lasted 3 weeks and anyone could get a permit. I remember growing up in Vancouver, where literally during that three-week period, the men in our neighborhood would basically vacate on the weekend and drive up into the hinterlands of British Columbia and bag a caribou and bring it back. And one caribou provides meat that will feed a family all winter long and a good part of the spring. And so, and I remember almost everybody came back with a caribou, but it's because they were just so incredibly plentiful at that time. However, by 2009, North America's caribou population had declined to less than 10% of the level that it was at in 1910. And it's because they were overhunted. but it's thanks to hunting restrictions, including restrictions that were put on the Inuit, that the caribou population has since doubled. And this took a lot of negotiation because the Inuit were highly dependent on caribou for clothing. They made their clothes out of the skins, their shoes out of the skins. They used the horns. They used every part of the caribou, but they were particularly dependent upon meat. But it got to the point where they realized if we don't stop hunting, put some restrictions on the hunting in caribou, there'll be none left. And therefore, they got the Inuit to agree, okay, we're still going to let you hunt, but you're going to have to reduce your hunting by more than a factor of five, because we need these animals to recover so you can get to the point where you can actually hunt them a little. And basically, they banned hunting for everybody else. And so literally, just a little more than a decade, the caribou population has slightly more than doubled. And there's a possibility of getting it back to where it was when I was a child. And what they've discovered is that there's actually more money to be made by mega herbivore tourism than there is by mega herbivore hunting. And so bringing back these mega herbivores is going to have two big economic effects. It's going to reduce the amount of grass fires, grassland fires, because these are the creatures that eat huge amounts of grasslands, and they tend to eat that's most likely to burn. And therefore, when you do get a grass fire, it's not nearly as devastating as it is when you don't have the mega herbivores feeding on the grasses. So the hope is this tripling that we've seen in grassland fires in the United States can be reduced by increasing the population of wild mega herbivores. In the continental United States, that typically takes the form of elk and moose. And elk and moose are nowhere near the abundance levels they were before Europeans came to North America. The bison are way down. So if we can bring back the bison, bring back the moose, bring back the elk, this could have a huge factor on reducing the number and intensity of grassland fires that are occurring in the United States. And even though Canada has a lot more of these creatures, it's still nowhere near the level it was before the Europeans began to settle. So one big economic benefit, you're going to have less damaging grass fires. You're going to bring it back down to the optimal level for the health of the grasslands and the health of the mega herbivores. But a second economic benefit is tourism. Basically, North Americans have discovered there's more money to be made from tourists who want to get close and photograph these mega herbivores than there is in allowing people to hunt them. Yes, there's a financial incentive there, but it's actually a bigger incentive. So here, this next photo actually shows you an example where private citizens are raising caribou and getting them up to populations. And what you see here is that if you protect them from hunting, they actually grow more magnificent antlers than would otherwise be the case. This next one actually shows you how the population of elk, this is in Yellowstone, the population of elk is gradually going up. And also now that they've brought predators of the elk back into Yellowstone, they're getting healthier tribes or healthier herds of these elk. So elk, they're now allowing wolves, for example, to hunt the elk and also to hunt the bison that are there. And hey, this is a photo which actually shows you, this is in Yellowstone, where you actually get to see a bison and an elk in the same photograph. So they're actually beginning to come back. Okay, the second paper I want to talk about has to do with what's called the third pole. And if you look at other planets, we are finding a number of planets that have two poles, one of the North Pole and one of the South Pole. Planet Earth is the only known planet that's got three poles, one the North Pole, one the South Pole, and one near the equator. So this is Earth's first and largest pole, the first ice cap to form in recent history, and by far the largest pole. Literally covers virtually all of Antarctica with ice. The little brown spots there are indicating the parts that are not covered by ice. And the only reason they're not covered by ice is they're incredibly arid. They're so arid, they just don't get a lot of snowfall. Everywhere else, we see Antarctica covered with ice and thousands of feet thickness of ice. And this just shows you some of the inhabitants of Antarctica. And because they are not subject to predators, they do have predators when they're in the ocean. But when on the land, they don't have any predators. And so you can literally walk right up to them. I've known people that have been to Antarctica and says, yes, the penguins love human contact. They're not at all afraid of us. And then here's the second pole. And the turquoise area is a part of the North Polar region that's covered in ice in the wintertime. So this shows you the extent of Earth's second pole in February. This is from the years 1978 to 2002. So that's the average coverage of ice. And it has shrunk a bit since I was a child, because when I remember when I was a child, the entire St. Lawrence River and Gulf would freeze over in winter for at least 2 months. Now, as you can see in this image, you do get some ice forming off of Nova Scotia and Gaspé, but largely the St. Lawrence Gulf and river remain ice-free. But it's still the case that all of Hudson's Bay gets frozen over and all of Labrador gets frozen over. Also, I remember too, that the extent of ice would cover much more of Alaska than it's covering today. And this next slide shows you the extent of the polar ice cap in the summertime. And again, this is the average for 1970 to 2002. And actually we're talking September because you do get a warming in July and August, but there's a time constant there. And you get to see that the polar ice cap in September is much smaller than it is in February. And hey, this is a shot of the North Pole. And yeah, they actually do have scientific sites up there at the North Pole. But the paper I'm referring to really talks about the third pole. And the third pole is over the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau. It covers over a little more than 1 million square miles. So, and actually has more ice over it in the summertime than what you see in the summer ice cap. The winter ice cap is bigger in the north of the polar ice cap, but not the the southern or the summer ice cap. And this shot actually shows you a satellite image in the summertime of the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas. So you see there's a lot of ice there even in the summertime. And this shows you what it looks like in the summertime. And you can see there's glaciers everywhere. There are 14 peaks that are over 8,000 meters. Or to go back here, one reason why you've got ice here is because of the elevation. Every 1,000 feet of elevation you go up, the temperature drops by 4 degrees. And when I go back to this slide here, everything that is colored here, everything that's not white, actually is above 1,600 meters, which is 1 mile. So this is showing you all the parts of that region that are above 1 mile in elevation, which means you're looking at about a temperature drop of 20 degrees compared to what you would have, say, over India. And the orange colored regions, they're not just over 1,600 meters, they're over 5,500 meters. So everything you see there that's orange colored or red colored, it's above 18,000 feet. And so 18 times 3.5, that means we're looking at about 60 degrees colder than the rest of the region. That's cold enough that anything above that 5,500 meters is going to be permanently covered in snow and in an ice. And this is just a shot of what it looks like. This is one of the lower elevation regions. This is looking towards the Himalayas from the south. And this actually shows you the Himalayas. In fact, that's Mount Everest there that you see right there in the middle. And the total quantity of ice in this third pole measured in 1978 was 14,000 cubic kilometers or 3,400 cubic miles. That's a lot of ice. So, and what the paper is all about is that the team headed up by Lee in their paper in the Nature Scientific Reports, again, this happened at the end of December that this was published. They use paleo ice surface reconstruction. I'll tell you briefly what that's all about, but basically show that the land area covered by the Himalayan glaciers has shrunk by 40% since 550 years ago. So over the last 550 years, it has shrunk by a total of 40%. But what they noticed is that valley floor tongues retreated by more than 100 meters in height. So this is an example of what they call a valley floor tongue, where you got kind of an ice field and you got a glacier coming off of the high ice field into a valley. And this is referred to as a glacier tongue. What they do is they kind of measure the bottom of the tongue and compare where it was 550 years ago. And what they discovered is the average retreat of the tongue was 330 vertical feet. This is not in the Himalayas. I took this photo in British Columbia. This is the southernmost ice field in British Columbia, just a little bit north of the Canada-US border. But the study that they were doing was comparing what happens to valley tongue glaciers that end in a cascade. So look at the bottom there. You can see that there's a cascade of liquid water flowing out from the bottom of the tongue. So yes, the tongue is melting and that feeds that cascade there, as opposed to where you get a glacier tongue coming off an ice field. And this is an ice field in a slightly more northern part of British Columbia. And here it ends in a lake. Now, to give you some context here, this glacier tongue is not just the white stuff you see. You look over to the left, you can see that there's ice that literally covers the whole top half of the lake. The problem is the bottom half, you've got a lot of debris on top of the ice. So that explains why you see a combination of ice crevasses, but also a lot of boulders, a lot of dirt on top of it, because this thing is flowing down a steep slope and it carries a lot of rock material with it. But the difference is, instead of ending in a cascade, it ends in a lake. And Lee and his team basically said, hey, if it ends in a lake, this is a glacier that's going to melt 2.5 times faster than a glacial tongue that ends in a cascade. And I actually took photographs from above the glacier and at the end of the lake. So you can see all these little icebergs in the lake from the melting. And you can see off to the right, you've got a glacier that is ending in a cascade. The one off to the left is actually ending at this particular lake. But going back to the paleo ice surface reconstructions, the two arrows you see there basically show you where the glacier was 550 years ago. And so you can see all the erosion there. That's, you can see where the ice is retreated. And what these scientists did is they went to different parts of the Himalayas and basically used their geological measurements to determine where the size of the glacier or the ice field 550 years ago. And as they did studies going from the arrow down to the lake, for example, they were able to determine what the melt rate was at different times from the top of that edge down to the bottom of that edge. And, here it shows you how it can be done. This is a much larger ice field where you got several glaciers coming together to make a tongue. But the arrow off to the left shows you, again, the extent of this ice field 550 years ago. And if you look off to the left, you can see where you got basically loose rock and then bedrock. They can go to all these places and determine where the top of the ice was at different times throughout the past 550 years. And this is what they came up with. Over the last 550 years, the lowering of ice, this is the lowering over all the ice fields and glaciers, not just the tongue, but the entire ice mass, and basically demonstrated that if you look at all the ice over the Himalayan glaciers, all 15,000 of them, we see that the average drop in height was between 0.011 and 0.02 meters per year. So that would be like 1 to 2 centimeters. It was dropping by 1 to 2 centimeters per year. But then they were able to measure the rate of lowering from 1975 to 2000. And would you notice it gone up by a factor of 10 or 20 times. Now we're looking at 21 centimeters of lowering of ice every single year. And then they went from 2000 to 2016 and said now it's 43 centimeters drop per year. And basically that's what this paper is all about, saying, hey, we're in danger of seeing this third pole disappearing. It could literally disappear within a few centuries at the rate at which it is dropping, and how the acceleration of ice loss far exceeds that of any other glacial system in the world. You want to know what ranks second? It's the Rockies, particularly the Canadian Rockies. The photos I've been showing you, we're also seeing a very rapid drop, but nowhere near the rate of drop that we're seeing in the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau. So this ranks first in the world, and it is a major concern because 20 major rivers flow out of the Tibetan Plateau. I mean, if you look at this map here, you can see all the major rivers that flow through India and Pakistan come from the Tibetan Plateau. Likewise, all the major rivers that go into China come out of the Tibetan Plateau. Likewise, all the major rivers that flow into Southeast Asia come out of the Tibetan Plateau. These rivers are responsible for providing the food for about 3.5 billion people on the face of the earth. And so, again, the concern is if all this ice melts away, you're no longer going to have the food to feed these 3.5 billion people. You say, well, that's just the Asians. No, as the paper points out, it's not just a crisis for the Asians. It's a crisis for the entire world. And this is in my book, Weathering Climate Change, how the reflection of sunlight off of the third pole is four times more efficient than the reflection of light off of either the North Pole ice cap or the South Pole ice cap. And so per unit area, the degree of planet cooling you get from sunlight being reflected off of the third pole is four times greater than the degree of cooling you get from either sunlight reflecting off the South Pole or the North Pole. So the paper basically says preserving the third pole is in everyone's best interest. We all should be concerned and be worried about this very rapid drop in ice that's taking place in the Himalayas about the Tibetan Plateau. And one reason why we haven't noticed that increased lowering has actually increased the water flow into those 20 major rivers. And so people living in India and China and Southeast Asia say, hey, we got more water than we've ever had before. This is great. No, it's not great, because what they have is a lot of water that's flowing into the Indian and the Pacific Oceans. That water is not all being used for agriculture. And the fact that they got more water than they used to have means that they're going to run out faster. And so it's actually important that we lower the degree of melting, which will lower the amount of water flowing out of those rivers. But it does mean that we're going to have a guaranteed food supply for a much longer period of time. Now, some of the things, this is not in the paper. So this is just coming from me here at Reasons to Believe, because the paper basically says, hey, we got to eliminate all fossil fuel burning to save the third pole. Well, that's not realistic in a short period of time, but some things that are realistic in a short period of time that would have a dramatic effect in minimizing the melting of ice in the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas. Number one would be, let's drain all the lake terminating glaciers. Now, going back to this one, it'd be an easy thing for some engineers to come in. In fact, you could probably do it just a single helicopter or two, a drop, basically dig a trench and drain the lake. The tourists, by the way, love coming to this place because it's a place of incredible beauty to see all these icebergs. But this, hey, you know what? There's not that many tourists that even are fit enough to get to this place. So let's drain the lake. And if we drain the lake, this glacier is going to be around for tourists to see a lot longer period of time. Because, yeah, this glacier is actually in danger because of the rapid rate at which it's melting. By the way, having visited this place, I found out from one of the mountaineering guides, this lake is only 20 years old. 20 years ago, there was no lake. But because of the rapid melting of this glacier, a lake has formed. So it's only 20 years old, and that we can drain the lake. It'll be just like it was 20 years ago. And as the guides were telling me, this glacier was actually a more spectacular thing to see 20 years ago than it is today. So this could be done all over the Himalayas. These lakes are fairly easy to get to. They're not at extremely high elevations. So let's just drain all the lakes, and that will cut down the melting, at least of these glaciers, by a factor of 2.5 times. The second thing we can do is replace all coal burning units in Asia with natural gas. That can be done immediately. The natural gas could be delivered at a cheaper price than the coal. So there's a huge economic benefit. You only get half the greenhouse gas release from burning natural gas than you do from burning coal. Because when you burn natural gas, it goes to carbon dioxide and water. And water is a greenhouse gas, but if you put more water in the atmosphere, you actually get more rain falling. It doesn't really increase the greenhouse effect of the atmosphere. So you're basically lowering the greenhouse gas emissions immediately by a factor of two. I know of no other way of lowering greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere more rapidly and economically than just simply saying, forget about burning coal, we're going to burn natural gas instead. And it has a second benefit. When you burn natural gas, there's no black carbon soot, there's no sulfur aerosols, there's no nitrous aerosols. And so that also contributes to cooling the planet. And when you got less black carbon soot, that means you're going to have whiter looking glaciers. And so the glaciers won't have as much of this black and the brown stuff on it as it has right now. And this would mean that the glaciers in the Himalayas would melt at a slower rate because they wouldn't have the deposition of these black particulates, but it would also dramatically lower the melting of glaciers in the U.S. and Canadian Rockies, because almost all the black carbon soot that gets deposited on North America's glaciers come from Asia. So if we can eliminate the burning of coal in Asia, and by the way, this would be an economic benefit for all the nations of the world. And we've got plenty of natural gas to make that happen. And North America is sitting on a huge deposit of natural gas. We could literally supply the whole world. And my whole point is we can use that natural gas to buy us the time to transition, say, to thorium nuclear power reaction, which would actually deliver energy at a price, an order of magnitude cheaper than what you can get from any fossil fuel. That to me is an effective quick way to move from fossil fuels to what they call a green energy, where we're not pumping any greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Hey, I've gone way over time. By the way, Mark and Jamie, feel free to stop me and say, Hugh, you've gone way past your 35, maybe I think 45 minutes is what I see on my clock. So my apologies. I was hoping to jump into our Bible lesson. We'll get to that when I get back. We're talking about the biblical testing method and how to apply the biblical testing method to the different creation texts in the Bible, as well as the book of nature. So my apologies. I'm going to stop right here. And we'll take a Q&A. And as I've announced before, we're going to do the Q&A, half of it in the webinar and half of it in the web meeting. When you get to the web meeting, you can ask your questions through your microphone and your camera. Here in the webinar, put it in the chat feature and we'll get to it. Great. But yeah, people suggested, can you please split it into two? So that's what we're doing today. This is an experiment. Tell me whether you like it or you don't like it.
All right, well, we have some questions left over from the earlier morning. The first one is from Mark Durham, who says, looking at the rapture of the church from a premillennial viewpoint, the timing of the rapture appears to be pre-tribulation. Romans 5:9, 1 Thessalonians 1:10, 1 Thessalonians 5:9, Revelation 3:10, and 1 Thessalonians 4:18 all indicate that believers will avoid God's wrath. What is your take on this controversial subject?
Well, it is a controversial subject. And just to be clear, it's premillennialists that believe that there will be a rapture event. Postmillennialists, amillennialists, they take the position there won't be a rapture, although some postmillennials say it happens right at the end of the millennium, which is theologically not that distinguishable from God or Jesus Christ after the millennium, taking us all away to the new creation. But yeah, all premillennialists do hold that there will be a rapture event. And that event is where Christ comes down and takes all the believers away from planet Earth. And so they're taken away. And you know, some the support for that is what you see in Revelation 6 and 7. Which you see at the end of Revelation chapter 6, it predicts a time will come when the entire human population of planet Earth will be cursing and blaspheming God the Father and God the Son, which is something that Christians don't do. And so people are saying that means there can't be any Christians on the face of the earth at that time. And what Revelation tells us, there comes a time afterwards when there will be believers in Jesus Christ. And so there's only a brief period when we've got the entire population of the world blaspheming Jesus Christ and God the Father. And yes, those passages that Mark just cited us tell us that we will be protected from the wrath of God. And again, in premillennial theology, just before the second coming of Jesus Christ to planet Earth, you have this, what's called a period of tribulation. And during that period of tribulation, it's in the book of Daniel. It's also in Revelation 6 and 8 and the 16, that there's this period of time when you've got wars and famines, pestilence, disease, you've got earthquakes, and you have basically God, as it says in the book of Isaiah, chapter 24, where God steps back and allows humanity to express their sin, allows us to pollute ourselves, literally to pollute our environment to death, and we have all these consequences. I want to make it clear, a lot of people think God's the one that pours out all these dooms upon the planet. It's basically saying, hey, you want to run things your own way outside of my control? I'm going to let you do that for a short period of time, and you're going to see the consequences of allowing things to run according to what you think is right, as opposed to coming to me and getting guidance on how to run things. And it's basically God shaking people to their senses. And you see this in Revelation 6, 8, and 16. Revelation 6, it says, these disasters are going to impact and shake up a quarter of the world's population. Revelation 8, a third of the world's population. Revelation 16, all the world's population. It's basically in the context of God wanting as many people to repent of the rebellion against him and to submit themselves to the authority of God and receive forgiveness for all their sins. God wants us to redeem as many human beings as possible. And if necessary, he's going to shake up people to the realization, hey, I thought there was no God. Clearly, there has to be a God to explain what's going on here. And I want a relationship with that God. God loves us enough that he's going to do this. So because some people need to be shaken up a little more than others. Now, the big debate amongst premillennialists, this day of wrath, is that distinct from this period of tribulation? And I want to make it clear in Revelation 6, 8, and 16, it says, this is God shaking up unbelievers so they come to their senses. All these disasters are not for the believers. God will protect the believers. As it says in the book of Ezekiel, and it says in the book of Daniel, God wants to show to the world the difference between what happens to people that are submitted to his authority and what happens to people that are not. So God's people have the assurance they will be protected. And it's also going to be an opportunity that God gives to Christians to go to these people and say, hey, you know where real security lies? It's not in your bank account. It's not in the government. It's not in your family. It's only in your relationship with Jesus Christ. So it's going to give us a wonderful opportunity to bring a huge number of people to faith in Jesus Christ. But my personal theological perspective on this is the day of wrath is not the same as the tribulation period. And when I was teaching the Revelation class, we went through all the New Testament texts that talked about this day of wrath compared to the tribulation period. And the day of wrath is basically the latter half of the tribulation period. We're guaranteed to be protected from the day of wrath, but we're not going to be protected from the tribulation period. And the key biblical text there would be 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the first dozen verses by that, which basically says, when the Antichrist comes upon the scene, the unbelievers will not recognize him as the Antichrist, but believers will recognize him as the Antichrist, and believers will now know the time is short to bring an uncountable number of people to faith in Jesus Christ. So this is what's going to motivate Christians to say, hey, there's only a few years left. We got to do everything we can to bring about this host of believers as we can. Now we know the clock is running. And so just knowing that that clock is running. But it's that text that tells us that believers will be here on the face of the earth when we do have a dictator ruling over all the nations of the world and ruling over the world economic system. But the day of wrath does not begin until halfway through the ruler of that dictator. But that tells us we're going to be here for the first half. So my personal position on the rapture, I call it pre-mid. I believe it's going to occur 1 to 3 weeks before the midpoint of the tribulation period. And you say, can't you be more precise than that? The Bible is clear. No man knows the hour of the day. And when I taught on this, I said, when you see the numbers in Revelation and the book of Daniel on how many days or weeks or months go by, recognize we're getting the dates, though only three significant figures, not four significant figures. No man or woman knows the hour or day for any fulfillment of biblical prophecy. Look at Noah. He went on board the ark, and it was another 7 days before the rain came down. No one knows the hour or the day.
Thank you. Still have a few questions. Jay Groman asks, are there any specific articles on the RTB website regarding how we define human race? And he clarifies that by saying he's referring to the difference in races today and how or whether we should define them.
Yeah, good question. I was actually answering some questions like that on Twitter this morning where people are saying, hey, haven't we evolved? And the whole point was people were confused about the definition of a human being. We humans are created in the image of God. The Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis, they did exist. They were real creatures. They were bipedal primates, but they did not have the image of God. And evidence for that is, notice we see no technological advance. Yes, they were using tools, but the tool use did not exponentially increase over the period of time they're on the face of the earth. And we see no evidence that any of these species had symbolic capability. Now, the specific question about races, the real expert on that is my colleague, Faisal Rana. He's a biochemist and a biophysicist. And if you go to our reasons.org website, you'll see numerous articles he's written on the origin of human races and how these races do develop over time. He's also got a video that you can get. I think the video is actually titled The Origin of Races. So you can get that as a DVD. But what you'll see in Fuzz's articles and DVD is that the genetic differences between human races today is very slight. It doesn't take much genetic diversity to alter the skin color. And actually documents that you can change the skin color of a small human population if you move their environment, put them in a different location, give them a different diet, give them different environmental pressures, you can actually see a substantial change in skin color in as little as four generations. And where we see the greatest genetic distinction between races is not between the blacks and the whites. It's between the Zulu blacks and the Bantu blacks. And if you go to South Africa, the Bantus and the Zulus live relatively close together, but they have a long history of not intermarrying with one another. And so it's in Africa where we see the greatest genetic diversity. And people said, well, maybe that proves that Adam and Eve were living in Africa. Not necessarily so, because what we notice in Africa is that the black tribes have this long history going back hundreds of generations where they simply say, we're not going to intermarry with a different tribe. So they stay within their tribe. That's preserved the genetic diversity. Whereas in Europe, Africa, and North and South America, there was a lot of intermarriage going on. And so you see much less a distinction in the genetics. And so, that's what's so phenomenal is that, and I've been to South Africa. You can actually, the color is quite similar in their skin, but you see facial distinctions that are different between the Bantu blacks and the Zulu blacks. So it's not that big a deal. And you know what I find interesting, we humans make a big deal about our racial differences. We don't seem to care about the color differences amongst our cows or dogs or cats. I mean, if you look at other mammals on the face of the earth, it's clear that color diversity is simply a matter of adaptation. It's not macroevolution, it's microevolution. But again, I commend to you the articles in the DVD by my colleague, which basically makes the point, hey, there are trivial differences amongst the races, and you can get color differences in the skin quite quickly if you change the environment, which means we humans really shouldn't be caring about the colors of our different skins to the degree that we do.
So Fuzz Rana or Faisal Rana is the one who they should look up on the RTB website to find right. The answer to that question about race.
Right.
Okay, good. It's about 10 minutes to 12. Do you want to keep on going with this?
Let's take one more question, then we'll move into the webinar or okay. web meeting, I mean.
Okay. Keith Wilson asks, Paul states that all Israel will be saved. Do you think that God will squeeze Jewish people out of other countries by persecution?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, how are you going to get all the Jews of the world living in the land of Israel? And, one way to do it is persecution. That explains how many Jews wound up going to Israel after World War II. It's like, hey, we were virtually wiped out in Poland. So we're not going to live in Poland anymore. They moved to Israel. And so there was mass migrations out of Russia, out of Europe. after World War II, leaving the persecution there and settling in the land of Israel. Now we're seeing American Jews leaving the U.S. and going to Israel. And what's motivating them is not persecution. What's motivating them are economic interests, realizing, hey, I can, the economic climate that they see in Israel in the context of several Jews here in the U.S. looks more attractive. And so there's economic incentives causing people to move to the land of Israel. Likewise, we've seen a lot of Jews in Africa exit the persecution there and living in the land of Israel, particularly true in the nations like Ethiopia, which had a large Jewish population. A lot of them have left and are now living in the land of Israel. So I'm guessing this is going to continue. It'll be a combination of economic incentive and persecution. But keep in mind, Ezekiel does predict a time will come when Israel, on a per capita basis, will be the wealthiest nation in the world. In that case, there's going to be a strong economic incentive from Jews all over the world to say, hey, I'm heading to Israel. And we're more than halfway there already. Okay, what we're going to do, we're going to continue the Q&A time, or we're going to do it in a web meeting. In a web meeting, everyone can turn on their microphones and cameras or not. When you get into the web meeting, you've got an option. If you want to remain semi-anonymous, you can leave your camera off, leave your microphone off, put your questions in the chat, but also you've got the freedom to ask your questions with your microphone on and your camera on. And just like we've done in previous weeks in the web meeting, we're going to alternate between a live question from someone with their camera and microphone on and a question that comes in the chat. And we're also going to alternate that with testimonies. And what I love about the Paradoxes class, we got some amazing people in the class. And so just like with the previous weeks, if you've got a short testimony on how you've had a significant spiritual conversation, either with an unbeliever or a believer in the past few weeks, we're going to give you an opportunity to share that. So we're going to alternate between camera question, chat question, and then a testimony. So what I'm going to do is share a screen again so that, where is the share screens feature? Here we go. And just show you the slide. Here we go. This is a URL you're going to need to get into the web meeting. And when you're in the web meeting, you will be put into a waiting room. Give me a few seconds to move you from the waiting room into the web meeting. And hey, if you got things to do and want to join us in 10 minutes, I will see you in the waiting room and I'll move you over. So keep in mind, I do get a signal when someone's in the waiting room. So whatever time you join us, we'll be able to move you into that meeting. So with that, and again, this is the same URL we've been using. It's on paradoxes.org if you forget. So those of you that can join us in the web meeting, please do. And with that, I'm going to end the webinar and start up the web meeting.
You make sure to promote Jamie in the meeting.
Yeah, I'll make sure. I think he can join automatically, but if not, I'll make sure that he becomes a co-host because that really helps the Q&A time.
All right.
Okay, here we go.